Good afternoon. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. I thank you very much for joining us today for Dialogue. Our topic today is the Ein Garandal archaeological site in Jordan, which is being slowly excavated by a crew of faculty and students with the University of Tennessee, and a few of them have joined us today to talk about the site. Would you all introduce yourselves and tell us how you're affiliated with UT?
I'll begin. I'm Dr. Erin Darby. I'm an associate professor of religious studies with a focus in early Judaism and archaeology.
I'm Samantha Gregorish. I'm a senior here at UT majoring in sociology and religious studies. So I was a student at the DIG helping with research there.
I'm Robert Darby. I'm a lecturer in the School of Art, and I focus on ancient Greek and Roman art and archaeology.
I'm Ashley Cornell. I'm a senior religious studies major student, and I have a minor in classics.
So you all have some, well, Erin and you and Robert have some background in archaeology.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, although archaeology is an interesting, it's sort of a fragmented field in the U.S. So unlike Europe or the Middle East where you could have a department of archaeology, here in the U.S. you find archaeologists in many different fields or departments. So even though Robert and I are co-directors of the same project, he is in the School of Art, I'm in religious studies at UT. We have archaeologists in anthropology, in history, in classics. So it's a interesting field. It's very interdisciplinary, but it also then feels fragmented to people because they always say, well, why aren't you and Robert in the same program? And that just has to do with the way archaeology is taught in American universities.
It seems like it would be better that way just because you get so many different viewpoints on these inanimate things that you're looking at.
I think you also get a disciplinary benefit from collaborating from different kinds of orientations and backgrounds. So the way somebody like me, who's a Near Eastern archaeologist, approaches a question might be different than the way Robert, who's traditionally a Roman archaeologist, approaches a question. And then there's a whole other aspect of this project that are mostly anthropological archaeologists. And they answer questions in different ways as well. So I'd like to think that in its best version, this is a kind of check and balance so that we benefit from the strengths of all of our approaches, but we mitigate the downsides of each of our approaches. That could also just end up being fighting most of the time.
Well, then that's not to mention all of the specialists that we have work on our project, and all archaeological projects do as well. People who specialize in geoarchaeology, for instance, or archaeobotanical remains, things that go well beyond our fields of expertise.
Right.
That's a great thing. I don't have to do geoarchaeology because we have a geoarchaeology lab here directed by Howard Sear that's affiliated with the McClung Museum. So my job is to learn a lot from the specialists like Howard. It's my job to listen when Howard says we need to do particle size analysis. It's my job to understand how to integrate that within the larger framework of the research. But thankfully, I don't have to know how to do geochemical analysis of materials at the site. So UT in particular is great because we've got the hard sciences, we've got the social sciences, and we've got the humanities all working together. And I think the students as well come from a really wide variety of backgrounds. So like in Samantha's case, she has both a humanities and a social sciences background, and both of those things influence the way she deals with particular aspects of the dig.
Absolutely. And of course, you have a classics background, Ashley.
I just started.
Oh, okay. That must help. I mean.
Well, it was. The funny thing is, I actually started out here at UT as a biochem major with a minor in computer sciences. And gosh darn it, I took a class with Dr. Darby, and it was just fascinating. And the thing that really got me interested in it is the analysis, because you can apply that to any field. Just the way you go about, like you said, going about thinking about different questions, I find, especially when we're talking about method and theory, my background in computer science is very helpful, because you think about things abstractly, but being very conscientious about the way in which you model going about doing things was not something that I had seen before. So I really appreciated that. And it just kind of inspired me to shift my focus. And then going on this trip was just phenomenal, because seeing it all in action, you just understand it in a way that on paper, you just, it's very difficult to translate the value when people are saying, you know, oh, why should I go there? Or they're afraid about the logistical things. And they're like, oh, that sounds like a lot. And it's like, but you get so much out of it. And you, if I gave you a list of all of the things that I got out of going to Dig Jordan and, you know, being in country, experiencing the culture, meeting people, you would just have, you know, a whole ream of paper in your lap and saying, these are all the things that I learned this summer.
Well, let's start at the beginning. The official name of the project is the Ein Garendal Archaeological Project, or AGAP. What does the name Ein Garendal mean?
Well, Ein is the Arabic word for spring. And so we incorporated that into the name of the project because there is another site not terribly far from ours that also has the name Garendal. So we had two sites with the same name, and we needed to be able to distinguish between the two.
Is that a place name, Garendal?
It is a place name. It is not certain where the origin of that word comes from in Arabic.
Okay.
It's possible that it comes from the ancient Greek name of the place, which was Ariadela, and you can kind of hear the phonetic similarities, but it's not certain. So whether or not it is related, we had to distinguish our project from this other place. Now, some early explorers to the site had also referred to the site as Ein Garendal. So that's where that comes from, and that's the base name of it, is the spring in this place of Garendal.
I think it's, though, important to note that aside from a sort of historical accident of how you talk about the site, the naming the site after the spring, I think, is appropriate because the presence of water at the site is so significant as an explanation for why there is human habitation. And Robert's research in particular on the Roman army and bathhouses illustrates how significant the placement of water sources is, especially in this strip called the Wadi Araba that runs from the Dead Sea all the way down to the very edge of Jordan and Israel. So I do like the idea that we're in a desert, but the project isn't called the Desert of Garendal.
Right.
It's called the Spring of Garendal because there wouldn't be a site were there not a spring.
Sure. Makes sense. So geographically then, is it southwestern Jordan?
I guess if you wanted to think of it that way, right? It is right on the border between the modern states of Jordan and Israel. So if you were to leave the site and walk, I don't know how many meters in the westerly direction, Robert, how far would you say?
Maybe a mile.
You would be in Israel.
Oh, interesting.
It's right on the border. And the site from north to south is located, it's in the south of Jordan, about 60 kilometers north of the modern city of Aqaba, which many people know from the movie
Lawrence of Arabia.
Sure.
And in fact, Lawrence actually visited the site.
He wasn't very nice about it.
No, he visited the whole region.
Oh, he said some ugly things
about the
site?
He did. He talked smack about our site.
He referred to the Wadi Araba as being fit only for camels, and that the water was a brackish.
Yeah.
And he didn't spend a lot of time at the site. But so the site's located north of Aqaba and then about 40 kilometers southwest of the ancient city of Petra, which many people have also heard of. It's one of the new modern wonders of the ancient world.
Absolutely.
And totally worth visiting if you ever have an opportunity to go. It's one of the most impressive places I've ever been.
And both Ashley and Samantha had the chance to go and climb around Petra and experience that as well.
So cool.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
So it's close to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Can you put that in context of the history of the site is was it an outpost to for just the Roman Empire? Was it a site that had human habitation before the Romans?
So we don't have structures that predate the Roman period, but surveys, so people kind of wandering around in a systematic fashion collecting pottery that happens to be laying on the surface. Further up into the Wadi system that feeds our spring have found evidence going back to at least the Paleolithic. Right, Robert?
Yes.
So whether or not humans were at the particular place where our structures are currently located, they were in the region or the neighborhood through a variety of time periods. But we don't have built structures, especially not out into the main system, which is the Wadi Araba, before anything that we have that's Roman currently. I mean, you can always, like, archaeology is one of those funny things. I could say that today, and I could dig tomorrow, and I could be 100% wrong.
Right.
You're only as good as your last excavation season.
And there have been remains found, as Aaron mentioned, very nearby of Nabatean material, both pottery as well as what look like residual remains of like water systems and things up into the up the wadi, the valley. And when we're digging, we find just hints of the Nabataeans as well. Now, the Nabataeans are the indigenous people who lived in this area prior to the arrival of the Romans. Now, they're still there when the Romans arrive, but they eventually, the Nabataean kingdom is incorporated by the Roman Empire in 106 AD. So it's not a surprise that we have that Nabataean material. Our archaeological site, however, as Aaron mentioned, every structure that we've been working on has been very clearly founded during the late Roman period, so around the year 300.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes the archaeological identification a little bit easier because we're not looking through, I mean, we have multiple periods at the site, but they sort of start with the Romans around the year 300.
At least for the built structures. You get Nabataean pottery is quite fine and very lightweight, and so it ends up kind of being in your soil matrix. Maybe it's windblown, maybe it's, who knows how this material kind of gets around, but we've never found anything that was a structure that we could associate with a pre-Roman the occupation.
The building, the primary building at the site is a Roman fort. And then there are some secondary buildings located nearby. The Roman fort, you asked if it was an outpost.
Mm-hmm.
Yes and no. It is.
Because it's so close to the edge of where the empire
was.
Ah,
but an important thing is it's close to the edge, but the edge wouldn't have been, the edge would have been on the other side of Jordan. Right.
On the eastern side.
Right.
Yes.
So if you're listening and you're thinking about the geography here, and this is I find this hard to do without having my PowerPoint so I can point you to the Wadi Arba. But so Roberts worked at a number of these sites, and the border today between Israel and Jordan didn't exist. Right. So just to keep everyone oriented geographically when we're talking about edge.
Right.
We're not talking about modern nation state borders.
So the fort is related to a Roman military buildup along the eastern frontier, which happened right around the year 300. It probably sits back from the front. And if we think about it as part of a system of forts that were protecting a road or an ancient trade route up the Wadi Arba between Aqaba and the port at Gaza, then that's probably a better way to think of it. Sort of like, rather than a frontier position, they are just inside of the frontier, protecting the interior route.
When you're standing at the site,
mm-hmm.
can you give us a picture of what you see when you look out? Because I'm thinking, you know, flat desert. No.
No.
What's there?
We have, so I would say, I know Southwestern vocabulary doesn't convey it very well, but it's almost like a mesa. So the elevation changes are super dramatic. So when you're walking, I mean, it's already hot. So if you're not used to dry heat, then that's a little different. But then you look up and it's not just flat. You know, you have kind of more rolling hills, less dramatic than there are here. But there is elevation changes, and then the colors are just amazing. Just all these different colors of stone and sand and soil, and you have all these cool little bushes that look kind of like, I don't know what they are, but they look like twiggy rosemary kind of bushes. And
Like sage? Or
Yeah, they're like an acacia shrub. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not just like a sandbox. It's a lot to look at, and when we are driving up to the site in the mornings, you know, it's like 3 or 4 in the morning and the sun's coming up and everything kind of turns purple and then kind of rosy, and then it goes into the daytime colors. It's just beautiful.
So the site itself sits down in the valley between these.
Right. So the Wadi Arba was formed by the same seismic activity that ended up with the Great Rift Valley. That's one of the reasons the Dead Sea is the lowest place in the face of the earth. Right. So this is a continuation of the same kind of activity going from the Dead Sea and stretching south. The Wadi Arba is it's up against other regions, like on the Israeli side, the Wadi Arba butts up against what we would call the Negev Desert. But as desert systems, they're unique. right? So the Wadi Arba has a number of microclimates within it. Our site happens to be surrounded by dune sea, which is not true for the entire Arba Valley. Other parts, that's not the case. Where Robert used to work on the Israeli side was covered with mud flats.
Oh, okay.
And that's just right down the street.
Just north of us, the dune sea sort of levels out, and it becomes more rocky the further north you go towards Petra.
And then, as you suggested, you have mountains on the Israeli side and mountains on the Jordanian side. The Jordanian side, I think, is the mountains, I think, perceive them as being sort of more dramatic and a bit higher. But I've worked, both of us have worked on both sides and in the mountains on both sides. So there is, as Ashley says, there's quite a lot to look at from a photographic perspective. It's very, very striking. I don't know, Samantha, what your experience was the first time you stepped off and saw the site.
I was kind of in awe of the whole thing because, like Ashley mentioned, when you drive up in the morning, you're watching the sun hit the mountains, and just seeing the sun hit sandstone as it's coming up was the first bit that I got where I just started to realize how beautiful this place that we were in was and how really amazing once you can see like all the little things, because it does change so quickly from one area to the next, even in us just going down Wadi Arba. And then when you step off, it's that more sand dune, but there's also the mountains right there, and it was just gorgeous. It really was such an interesting environment, because I'm from Tennessee, so I'm from like green mountains, and so stepping off and seeing like sandstone mountains is a completely different feeling, but it's still gorgeous and just really, yeah, it just fills you with that sense of awe for this completely different climate but gorgeous area.
And I think Howard would be mad at us if we didn't mention the glorious alluvial fans. So as you're driving up and down the Wadi Arba, there's subsidiary wadi systems that empty into this big, broad Arba Valley. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's very striking if you're not used to that part of the world is when you're driving and you see the mouth of these subsidiary wadis that kind of end up meeting perpendicularly with the big Wadi Arba.
Right.
It's so impressive to see the amount of material that's brought through those during the seasonal rainfall. So, I mean, you think of the desert as the desert, but at least at our site, and I think at many sites, seasonal rains, although measured in millimeter, is not that high. You could be raining way up in the subsidiary system, and then the flash flood brings all of this material and deposits it in the mouth of these wadis. And that ended up being a problem for the Romans, too, actually. So it's funny, I didn't think that several years into our project, one of the biggest questions we would have is, what's the impact of flooding in the desert?
I'm Chrissy Kuiper, and we're back with Dialogue. Aaron and Robert Darby, Ashley Cornell, and Samantha Gregorish are here to talk about the Ein Garandal Archaeological Project in Jordan, also known as Dig Jordan, for those who take part in this field school every year. So let's go back to what you were saying before the break, Aaron. The climate of this place is, as you were saying, desert, but it has these seasonal rains that flood the wadi and bring detritus down into the system. So talk about how that was a problem for the Romans.
Well, so I think part of it is it depends on the year, how much material accumulates, right? So what the research has shown is that it varies from year to year. And so I don't think that the Romans had a consistent experience with flooding, right? But the research up until this point, and this is all done through our Laboratory for Environmental Archaeology here at UT that's in the McClung Museum, so we should give a shout-out to how great they are.
Absolutely.
But what Howard has found is that the Roman surface looked quite different than the modern surface. So all of these sand dunes we're talking about here today probably didn't exist when the Romans showed up. In fact, the site may have significantly altered over time. And so what the Romans may have seen, according to Howard, is these sort of semi-stable landforms that we don't have bedrock. So when you get to the bottom, it's not hard the way you would think about it. We have kind of virgin, I don't know if Robert would call it soil, or kind of chalky.
It's more like a gravel bed.
Right. Oh, and okay. So they may have been able to see that slightly at a higher topographic level than what was surrounding it. They were certainly able to kind of to guess where the flooding should have gone, because you can see where the channels may have been. But they built a bathhouse in the middle of the desert. And so probably as a side effect of that, they may have altered the paths that the water took and may have made the flooding actually worse on themselves. It could have altered the course the water came out of the subsidiary Wadi Garandal. And they did build a fort in the way. of it. So Robert can talk a little bit about excavations in the gate and what we've seen there that are structural adaptations that seem to be dealing with some of these problems.
So now the gravel bed that you were talking about, Robert, is it sandstone gravel? What is it?
I mean, I think it's just...
Chalky. It's very chalky.
It's the... You used a good archaeological term, detritus. I think it is just the broken down material that's coming out of the wadi that was visible, and they may or may not have cleared it off, flattened it out for the construction of the fort. The belief that maybe the sand dune field wasn't there or wasn't as deep is because they were able to build entirely on this gravel bed. Mm. Now, when you go to the site, there's over 10 feet of sand that cover the ruins. So, for instance, when Samantha and Ashley came out, they couldn't even see any of the site except for perhaps the tops, the very tops of the walls where we had already dug. There's forces at work in terms of both wind, water, and then the big one that Samantha mentioned but we didn't get into is the sun. at least for the field school, it is our... It comes up in the morning, and it is our nemesis until we leave.
Well, yeah, it's the summertime. We were going to get around to this, but we'll go ahead and talk about it. It's the summertime in the desert.
Yeah, it's not ideal, but it's when they're out of school.
Yeah.
So we're stuck with it.
Yeah.
It's very hot, and by the time I think we finish up with breakfast by about 9:30 or so, when you step out into the sun, you can feel... the temperature getting very hot to the point where we've got a kind of a race for about an hour and a half until we have to go. And we stop at noon. So
we often like to think what would a Roman soldier stepping out into this space for the first time would have thought, right? Even if you didn't have the same kind of dune sand, you're still dealing with this extreme environmental situation. And then you're tasked with creating out of nothing a fairly substantial series of structures at this site that you somehow have to get supplies to, and you have to construct, and you've got to deal with, you know, supplying the troops. And that sun was, some people have argued that there might have been a slight warming or cooling in this period, but generally speaking, we're not talking about a variation that big. So they would have experienced, very similar to our students, very extreme heat.
And I would think that they would be on the defensive, too, in some respects. I mean, even if they're building, they're still wearing, armor and
I assume they weren't out there naked or something.
Right.
Naked soldiers building the fort. Yeah.
Which would be the way to go.
Right,
you know?
Right, I mean, for sure. Except for that whole, skin cancer thing.
Well, they do have a nicely constructed Roman bathhouse at the site. So at least there was a chance to escape from the elements.
There was a goal.
And relax.
Yeah. Although it's a heated bathhouse, so one wonders how helpful that really is at the end of the day.
Hmm.
So it's not hot enough, so we must be hotter.
So tell us what is there. You've mentioned the fort, and there's a bathhouse.
Right, and those really are the two primary structures. The Roman army didn't, the unit that was stationed there was what we call an auxiliary cohort. It was not tied or part of one of the Roman legions, the big military units that most people are familiar with, at least the term legion.
Mm-hmm.
The Roman army was divided into two parts, the legions and the auxilia. And the auxilia was drawn from the provinces. It was a way for Roman provincials to achieve citizenship early on. And it became a way for the Romans to also help control the empire. So they would recruit a group of people, let's say Nabataeans from Petra, and train them, give them a commander, put them into a unit, and then ship them somewhere else so that they would not cause the trouble for the Romans in the place where they were from.
Right.
So the unit at Garendal was the second cohort of Galatians. It was originally raised in Turkey, probably in the second century, brought down to Judea to take part in putting down the second Jewish revolt. And then presumably just stayed in the area for the next couple hundred, 200 years or so. And then was moved to this place around the year 300. They needed to build basically for, basically a new site to live at for whatever purpose the Roman authority decided to put them at this location. They had to build a new fort, which they did, obviously. But again, they had been there for, they had been in the region for a long time, but not in this spot. So the fort was constructed, and then a bathhouse was built nearby, about 75 yards away, to facilitate the bath. And then we have some evidence for a water system, bringing water from the wadi in the spring to the bathhouse. And then that is about all of what we've uncovered thus far. And it's probably because the fort was set out apart from any other sort of domestic structures or anything like that. There might be a village nearby, but we haven't found it.
We think it's probably up inside Wadi Garandal. Right? That's where, remember I mentioned those surveys that had collected a variety of kinds of surface pottery from.
Yeah.
So most of that material is up inside the subsidiary Wadi system, which makes sense, right? You don't actually want to build a big domestic structure right out in a place that has these kinds of climate conditions.
Well, sure. I mean, you'd want cover anyway, and you'd want to be closer to a system of water that is present all the time, I would guess.
Right.
How was the site found to begin with?
Well, presumably it was never completely unknown.
Wasn't all covered up?
Well, it was covered
up. It was mostly covered up.
Yeah, it was mostly covered up, but like this is a sort of phenomenon of 19th and 20th century European explorers proclaiming they have discovered this site. Well, most of the time they were led to the site by locals who already knew about it, you know, for probably their whole lives. Mm-hmm. So the first person to come and
write about it,
draw what he could see was a Czech explorer and ethnographer named Alois Musil, and he did this in 1902. About 5 years later or so, maybe a couple years after that, T.E. Lawrence, that is Lawrence of Arabia, came through as part of a larger survey in the region right before the start of World War I. Mm. He noted Musil's drawings and basically said no more needs to be done at the moment because Musil did a good job, and then he passed through the mountains and went off to Petra. From that point forward, after World War I, there were a couple of more explorers, this time an American named Nelson Glick, who visited the site. He thought it was Nabataean.
He thought everything was Nabataean.
He did, but
he was hoping everything was Nabataean.
He was very excited about the Nabataean.
Sort of a parade of people passing through every, 15, 20 years, kind of making notes about it. And then in 2009, mm-hmm. We went out to the site and came across the ruins of what looked like an exceptionally well-preserved building. And
we didn't just come across it. So Robert had identified the site as a place of interest for his research, but we were both of us at the American Center of Oriental Research, which is a research facility in Amman, Jordan. It's part of, America has a whole web of overseas research
right.
centers.
Right.
So Robert and I happened to be at the American Center in Amman, and a person who was doing a survey down in the south had discovered that there was some looting.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So Robert had already known about
right.
the site, but the thing that prompted us to go look at it was the concern that there was damage being done.
And there was, and what it appeared to be was that a large digging machine, a backhoe or something, had dug through what I was tentatively identifying as the Roman bathhouse. Mm. And so we collected all of the surface material and looked at that, and all of it looked like the kind of things you would find in a bathhouse. That is, it had heating pipes and bricks and things for a raised up floor. For those who aren't familiar, a Roman bathhouse is like it's the forerunner to a modern spa
or a sauna.
Yeah, you would go in, enjoy a cold bath, then you'd move into a slightly warmer room called the tepidarium, and then you would move into the caldarium or the hot room, which would be heated from under the floor and in the walls. And ours ended up containing a very nice hot tub. So, I mean, the idea of when we're talking about taking a bath, they had a really nice hot tub out there. But
what was it made of?
brick and concrete and stone.
Oh, okay.
And then plastered over. It was
local materials?
All local, yes.
Something.
Yeah.
Okay.
All local material.
Although the pottery all comes in from a wider distribution. So our ceramicist, Tiffany Key, who is in North Carolina, and she did her degree at North Carolina State University. Tiffany's analysis of the ceramics indicate that we don't necessarily have local production of those. So the site was tied to the trade routes, but we don't see it in the construction of the architecture so much as we see it in the pottery.
One of our former, a student that had worked at the site is working on the ceramic material for the bathhouse building material. And he thinks most of those things were made at Petra.
Mm-hmm.
So
at least 40 kilometers
they were bringing
away.
Some of those building materials down 40 kilometers.
But your stone is all quarried.
Right, the stone's all local.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then from 2009, then we started the excavation project.
We should say how sort of shocked we were at the preservation, right? So when we went down there, first of all, knowing what the average archaeological site is, you know, the little bit bottoms of walls that happen to mm-hmm. exist. And my background is in the Iron Age. So we're very excited if we get half a meter of wall preserved. That's a big day for us. And then when we knew there was looting as well, we went down mostly to document the site as it was and then realized that we were standing at the level of the tops of the walls and the lintels, not at the level of the floors.
We could see a doorway preserved, so we knew that we were looking at almost entire buildings rather than just the foundation levels.
If you had the money to do a big reconstruction and put the roof back on the bathhouse, you could probably fire the thing back up.
Right.
That's how well preserved it is. So one of the reasons there was anything after 2009 is because it became clear that only through excavation would you actually be able to document the site itself, and that nobody really had a clear sense, apart from a few people, of exactly how well preserved this could be and what could be under the surface.
How did you get this, just an aside for a moment, how did you get permission to go and start work on the site?
Well, initially, so I was serving as a research fellow at the American Center in Amman, as Aaron mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and the director there, Dr. Barbara Porter, had suggested that I should see about putting in for a survey permit with the Jordanian Department of Antiquities, which we did, mm-hmm. and you work with the Department of Antiquities and their representatives in any archaeological project.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important because a lot of times my students and people we talk to will say, oh, well, where's all the material? And who's it? You know, and we should say that this is all Jordanian material.
Right.
So,
and that would be true
so
in
stays,
Israel as
it
well.
It stays in country.
That's right. The standard procedure for the Middle East is that the polity that governs the space is who is that? That's who you deal with to get the permits to excavate. That's who you're working with to store the materials. That's who you're working with to get permission to do the analysis, and that's as it should be. It didn't used to be that way. It used to be that sometimes the explorer and the Turkish government would kind of split the finds.
Mm-hmm.
That's why for earlier excavations, you'll find the materials are kind of. You'll find them in all these different museums all over the world because people were allowed to walk out with them.
Right.
Whereas in best policy now for archaeology, it really has to be a partnership. And that's some of the things that we can talk about later when we get to the field school is looking at an excavation as a service community-oriented project so that it's not just us going over and digging up their stuff.
Yeah,
but we are providing certain kinds of services to the Department of Antiquities as partners in the process.
That's a good place for us to break and then come back, and we will talk about the field school and about what else you've managed to find at the site. You're tuned in to Dialogue here at WUOT. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. We're talking about the Ein Garendahl Archaeological Project, or AGAP, also known as Dig Jordan. You were saying that all the artifacts, everything remain in country. Have there been human remains found at this site?
Yes, and that's different countries in the Middle East have different policies about how you manage human remains. It's very much in the U.S. that's a very complex issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there is legislation here that governs what you can and can't do and how you involve the local community. Jordan doesn't quite have the same level of oversight, but so it's on the excavator to work really hard to interface with the Department of Antiquities and with, if you have local diggers, and we do, because we employ Bedouin from the village, that's associated with this territory. So so we do have a reuse of the site in the Islamic period as a cemetery. And there is, we have an amazing physical anthropologist who's from the university, from Pitt, right? From Jessica's from Pitt. And Jess does more than just tell you the age and, if you can, the sex of the remains. She can tell you, you know, what kinds of toil they did during their lifetime. Mm-hmm. She's looking at paleopathology. We can, certain kinds of analysis will allow us to see where the population traveled from. But we do an awful lot of work coordinating that initiative with the department and especially with our Bedouin workers. They do not perceive the inhumations as being related to their tribe.
Interesting.
They have a cemetery that's further up into that subsidiary Wadi system, but they still, you know, we want to make sure that they are comfortable with the kinds of work that we're doing. And in some years, that's meant we do everything in the field and we set up a field lab. And from excavation to analysis to repatriation, that all happens on the spot. And in other years, it's been more acceptable for us to take some of those remains back to our laboratory in Aqaba and then repatriate them. But all of the humans excavated at the site are then repatriated in a ritual fashion that is acceptable to our local community.
So who has been found?
Who or what?
Who, what?
We don't have their names.
All of it.
Are the dating of the burials, they all seem to date from quite a broad range of dates, but in the medieval period.
Mm-hmm. 12th to 14th century.
Yeah, okay. Identifying which group of people or who these people are is not, to that kind of level of accuracy, is not possible at the moment. There are no inscriptions. Mm-hmm. And it could be that these are... you know, tribal Bedouin that were moving up and down the area during that time period. But again, the disassociation of the local Bedouin tribe from them is interesting and does suggest a separation, that it's a different group of people. But we can't say for sure.
But on the other, you know, it used to be in the case in archaeology that people only dug the thing they were most interested in. So if you were a Romanist, you kind of plowed through everything above the period you really cared about. And then there wasn't a lot of oversight that you did. You dealt with that information either ethically or consistently. And so our job now as modern archaeologists is if you excavate it, you need to take great care to be in compliance with what the local government wants you to do, but also to meet scientific standards so that somebody who has very different research questions from you can come to your data in 20 years or 50 years and answer their questions. So we have attempted, I think, and this is sort of consistent, I think Samantha and Ashley both dealt with human remains this summer. We incorporate that into the field school as well. That has to be also important in the same way that the Roman material is important.
So no Roman soldiers found.
No, isn't that strange? We don't know where they are.
Very well, yeah. I mean, it just seems like there would at least be one.
But they're aliens. They just up into the UFO and they're out there.
We are also digging in the interior of the Roman fort, and the Romans didn't bury their dead where they lived. So presumably there are Roman burials in the area, but we don't know where they are.
Nor does anybody else. Right. No one's ever found burial caves or structures.
Thankfully, we've found a lot of really exciting finds that do tell us about the people that lived there during the Roman period and the Roman soldiers, just not their burials.
Yeah. Our physical anthropologist and our metal specialist would be very excited if we could find a Roman soldier in armor. Like, they would just make them the happiest people on the face of the earth.
Well, you know, it may be coming, I guess.
Yeah, you never know.
You never know. So how far outside the site do you work? I mean, you've said there are these two very distinct structures inside the site, but does your permit allow?
The permit allows just in the area. Like, you have to actually designate exactly where you are going to excavate.
The coordinates.
And makes it difficult for us is that technically where the site is located is on Jordanian military land. So we have a very
large base.
There's a Jordanian military unit that's about 2 kilometers up the Wadi system from the site. So, you know, we don't want to we don't want to anger anybody. We spend enough time getting permission to do, you know, to have this chance to excavate there that we don't want to go and make anyone angry by walking around areas we're not supposed to be. So we have surveyed and we have looked in the area, but our primary focus is on these structures that we've identified.
And so one more question about this, and then I really want to get to the students here to talk about the field school, but you've said multiple times that, you know, there's sand and detritus that blows in, that is flooded in. Do you have to re-excavate what you've already done every summer when you go back? Is there work being continued on the site when you're not there?
No.
Okay. It's just us. We try not. So we do everything we can to go top to bottom in a given unit in during the season. We have had to go back in on at least two different seasons, once in the fort and once in the bathhouse. And it is incredibly labor intensive.
Sure.
And in order to protect the ruins, we often, when we can, we backfill. So when we finish excavating, we fill it back up ourselves. So if we have to go back in, it's time and money to get that back out.
So right now, if you went to the site, you wouldn't know there was a Roman bathhouse there because it's completely filled in. And we have a early Christian, mid-4th century church inside the Roman fort. And you would see some of the complex outside, but you can't see anything in the main basilica because it's completely backfilled.
Right. So that's a pretty good lead-in for Ashley and Samantha, because they were working in that structure this summer at the field school in the early Christian church. So within the fort in 2015, we first
Encumbered the church in 2015, a little bit of it.
Yeah, we found the edge of this building that we later then went back the next season and excavated a lot more of it and found that we had a really early Christian church. This is probably dates to the mid-4th century, which is right at the time when the actual formalization of church architecture happened.
Not long after the Edict of Toleration that makes Christianity no longer illegal.
So you found inscriptions?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we have, so Robert can date the foundation of the fort itself because we had a very large gate inscription that UT students excavated in 2013, and that's now in the Jordan Museum.
The National Museum of Jordan, so that's been our big
find. So that gives us a foundation date. What we don't have is any kind of inscriptional evidence that tells us one way or the other when the fort or when the church was created. We have architectural reasons for supposing that it was created in the mid-4th century, and we're being very cautious. If we really wanted to be outlandish, we might say it was on the eve of the Edict of Toleration. They had already built this church. And I couldn't rule it out, but I would want data to say that.
Well, now that overlaps with the period where the Roman soldiers were still occupying the fort, correct?
Yes.
Correct.
And the Romans built this church.
So this is our earliest example, or one of the possibly the only example we have of an active Roman military unit building a church. We have other forts in Jordan and in the region which get churches
later
on in the 5th century, but this one is a 4th century construction, so it's exciting. And this season we went into the field to excavate two rooms that we had identified in 2017 as probably belonging to the church complex, and that's where these guys worked, Ashley and Samantha.
Well, tell us what you saw, ladies. When you first got there and you see this structure or half a structure, what were you thinking?
Well, you see this large complex, and the church itself it's very small. So it looks like it was kind of a dome structure or something like that, curved in, and it's very small. And it connects to a series of rooms, which were the rooms we were looking in. So we come in, and it looks like you're looking down what it was probably the entrance. But, of course, this is covered in sand, and some of the walls are gone, besides what they've uncovered from the past dig season that's still standing. And so Ashley's room, I think, was to the right. So if I'm looking straight at the church, it's to the back there are these series of rooms. And so to the right, there's this room that comes up and connects to another room, and that's kind of where she was working. And our room that I was working with Robert's group is directly behind the church. And so that was very interesting because we were in an area that was already kind of worked on before, that had been filled with backfill, and they had stopped because they had too many inhumations that they were dealing with, and so they just didn't have the time. And so we were going back in to try and get to the bottom of that room to try and figure out how it actually connected to the church and what its purpose was, because this probably, I believe we talked about, might have been pre-church room that was adapted mm-hmm. once the church was in addition to the fort.
Oh, okay.
That's correct.
So
that's
that was right. very interesting, too, because you're slowly moving down and trying to understand what you're seeing, and we're seeing rock tumble, which is probably where a doorway once was, and we're finding, we only encountered one inhumation in our square that was actually in our square. And so, because they had dealt with a lot of this prior, so we didn't have to, we got to go much farther down than really the other group. They had a much bigger area to cover as well. And so you're going down and you're finding different parts of walls. And that's another really interesting thing to note, too, is the wall structures change, too. So,
oh, so you can see the different mm-hmm. time periods.
And, yeah, because we had like a mud brick wall, and then that goes down into stone. And then we can kind of measure how far we're getting down with the stone at that point, and kind of based off another room that's already been excavated. So at that point, once we're seeing the stone, we're not, we have to take our time to make sure that we're getting all the material culture. That way we can analyze the data properly. But at the same time, at least for our square, that was a really exciting part because we know we're getting to the bottom of that floor and finding actually like solid finds.
What were the solid finds?
Intact pottery. So we found...
oh, great. Not just little bits.
No,
right?
Yeah, okay. Which was amazing. That was so... It blows your mind, really, because I'm not an archaeology student. I'm in religious studies and sociology. So I never in my life imagined I would be at a field school handling things that are like 4th century. But you're going down and we found pottery. We found something that's kind of like a cooking casserole. A lot of the stuff that you're going to find, at least what we found, is something that you're probably going to find from cookware, something sturdy that would have lasted that long. A lot of stuff, depending on how it's positioned, it would have made it at least, which is how we found a lot of our things lying on their side or protected somehow. The lamps are interesting because we couldn't really give them as specific information. We didn't have like a lamp specialist, but it's very interesting because they do source from so many different areas. You can identify like ones from Petra, one might have come from Amman. And so that just gives us an idea of like the network that the Romans had in terms of retrieving their materials,
right.
And so
and supplies and mm-hmm. everything mm-hmm. that they needed. Ashley, but we just have a couple of minutes left, so can you give us some impressions of Samantha was describing rooms. Mm-hmm. How big are these rooms?
Well, our room, quote unquote, was about the size of two normal squares. So a normal square is 5 meters by 5 meters. So ours was like a double width, so we got a double wide square.
And you had some material outside the room as well, so we gave you a very broad area.
Our squares hadn't been excavated, mostly the southeast, if I'm thinking my orientations correctly, had been uncovered. And but the rest of it, we were going from surface level straight down, which was very cool, very difficult, because it's a lot of fine work, and you're clearing off just centimeters at a time. So for people that are used to inches, 5 centimeters is about 2.5 inches. So you're going in 5-inch segments across the whole thing to make sure you're picking up everything. And if you're running into like a color change, which can tell you if there's charcoal in there, charcoal is very exciting.
Right.
And then because we can use that to date things or inhumations, we got lots of color changes in our squares. So we had 8 or 9 inhumations.
Mm-hmm. Quite a lot to handle.
All of them, all of the inhumations. I got to work on, I think 4. So that was very cool. It was an interesting experience. And, The whole staff was very good about the whole time being very communicative about, hey, you might encounter this. This is all the information on it. If you feel a certain way, come and talk to us. All of this stuff. So they were very helpful with the inhumations that we did encounter in that square.
See, I told you we wouldn't have enough time to get to everything. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. Our guest today has been Ashley Cornell, who you were just hearing, Samantha Gregorash, another student at UT, Aaron Darby, and Robert Darby. Aaron is with the Religious Studies Department, Robert with the School of Art here at University of Tennessee. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. It's almost a minute before 1 o'clock, and you have been listening to Dialogue here on WUOT.